thing when ice crystals are melted, becoming liquid water. But there is one very important difference between the two. The difference is that when the liquid water is cooled, as we all know, crystals reform with ease and create ice again. It is almost impossible to stop this happening, in fact. From the ice that jams up your freezer compartment to the snow that covers mountains, all are made from liquid water that has refrozen into ice crystals. It is the symmetrical pattern of these H2O molecules that accounts for the delicate patterns of snowflakes. You can melt and freeze water repeatedly, and the crystals will reform. With SiO2, things are different. When this liquid cools down, the SiO2 molecules find it very difficult to form a crystal again. It's almost as if they can't quite remember how to do it. Which molecule goes where? Who should be next to whom? Appears to be a difficult problem for the SiO2 molecules. As the liquid gets cooler, the SiO2 molecules have less and less energy, reducing their ability to move around, which compounds the problem. It gets even harder for them to get to the right position in the crystal structure. The result is a solid material that has the molecular structure of a chaotic liquid, a glass. Since failing to form a crystal is all you need to do to make glass, you'd have thought it would be rather easy. But it's not. Light a fire on the sands of a desert, and with a lot of wind to fan the flames, you may be able to get it hot enough for the sand to start to melt and become a translucent, sticky liquid. When this liquid cools, it hardens, and indeed becomes glass. But glass made this way will most certainly be full of bits of sand that didn't melt. It will be brown and flaky and will soon fall apart, becoming part of the desert again. There are two problems with this approach. The first is that most sand doesn't contain the right combination of minerals to make good glass. The brown color is a dreaded sign in chemistry, a clue that you have a mixture of impurities. It is the same with paints. Random combinations of colors don't yield pure results. Instead, you get brownish-gray hues. While some additives, so-called fluxes, such as sodium carbonate, will encourage the formation of glass, most will not. Unfortunately, despite being mainly quartz, sand is almost made up of whatever the wind blows in its direction. The second problem is that even if the sand has the right chemical composition, the temperatures needed to melt it are around 1200 degrees Celsius, much hotter than any normal fire, which tends to be in the region of 700 to 800 degrees Celsius. A lightning bolt will do the job, though. When one of these strikes the desert, it creates temperatures in excess of 10,000 degrees Celsius, which are easily high enough to melt the sand, creating shafts of glass called fulgurites. The word comes from the Latin fulgur, which means thunderbolt. These glass staffs of charred matter look uncannily like the images of thunderbolts that the gods of thunder, such as the Norse god Thor, were said to hurl in anger. They are surprisingly light, and this is because they are hollow. Although rough on the outside, inside is a smooth, hollow tube formed when the lightning bolt vaporizes the sand it first encounters. As the heat conducts outward from this entry hole, it melts the sand into a smooth coating for the tube. Further out, the temperatures are only high enough to fuse together the sand particles, making their edges rather rough. The colors of fulgurites reflect the composition of the sand in which they are formed, varying from gray-black to translucent if created in a quartz desert. They can be up to 15 meters long and are fragile, since much of their bulk is made of lightly fused sand. Until recently, they were thought of only as strange curiosities. However, because they trap bubbles of air inside themselves when they form, ancient fulgurites provide scientists studying global warming with a handy record of the desert climates of previous eras. In one part of the Libyan desert, there is an area of exceptionally pure white sand, comprised almost entirely of quartz. Search this part of the desert, and you may find a rare form of glass that looks nothing like a scruffy fulgurite, but which has instead the jewel-like clarity of modern glass. A piece of this desert glass forms the centerpiece of a decorative scarab found on the mummified body of Tutankhamun. We know that this desert glass was not made by the ancient Egyptians because it has recently been established that it is 26 million years old. The only glass we know like it is trinitite glass, the glass formed at the site of the Trinity nuclear bomb test in 1945 at White Sands, Nevada. Given that there was no nuclear bomb in the Libyan desert 26 million years ago, the current theory is that the extremely high temperatures that would have been needed to create such optically pure glass must have been produced by the high energy impact of a meteor. So, without the help of meteor strikes and nuclear explosions, how do you make the kind of glass that we would recognize in our windows, spectacles, and drinking glasses? Although the Egyptians and the Greeks made advances in glass-making, it was the Romans who really brought glass into everyday life. It was they who discovered the beneficial effects of flux, in their case, a mineral fertilizer called natron, which is a naturally occurring form of sodium carbonate. With it, the Romans were able to make transparent glass at a much lower temperature than would be needed to melt pure quartz. In the few locations where the right raw materials and fuel for the high-temperature furnaces were available, they manufactured glass in bulk and then transported it throughout the Roman Empire using their vast trading infrastructure, supplying it to local craftsmen who would turn it into functional objects. None of this was revolutionary, it had been done before, but by making it cheaper, according to Pliny, they put it within the reach of ordinary citizens. The Roman love of glass as a material is perhaps best demonstrated by their imaginative new uses for it. For instance, they invented the glass window. The word means wind eye. Before the Romans, windows were open to the wind, and although these might have wooden shutters or cloth curtains to keep out excessive wind and rain, the idea that a transparent material might be able to provide complete protection was revolutionary. Admittedly, their glass windows were small and fused together with lead because they did not have the technology to make large panes of glass, but they started our obsession with architectural uses of glass, which is still growing today. Until the development of transparent glass, mirrors were simply metal surfaces polished to a high shine. The Romans realized that the addition of a layer of transparent glass would protect this metal surface from scratches and corrosion, while at the same time allowing them to reduce the metal surface to a thickness of a mere fraction of a millimeter. This dramatically reduced the cost of the mirror and increased its effectiveness and longevity, and remains the basis for almost all mirrors today. The Romans' innovation in glass technology didn't stop there. Up until the 1st century AD, almost all glass was crafted into objects by being melted and poured into a mold. This worked well enough for coarse glass objects, but required enormous skill to make anything more delicate. To make a wine glass with thin walls, for instance, required a mold with a thin cavity, but it was hard to get the thick, gloopy, molten glass to flow into it. The Romans noticed, though, that solid glass could be made to behave like a plastic if it was hot enough. Using metal pincers, they could pull it into all sorts of shapes before it cooled down too much. They could even blow air into it while it was red hot, and when it cooled, they would have a perfect solid bubble. By developing this technique of glass blowing, they were able to blow into existence thin-walled wine glasses with a delicacy and sophistication that the world had never seen before. Until this time, drinking vessels had been opaque, made of metal, horn, or ceramic. The appreciation of wine was based solely on the way it tasted. The invention of drinking glasses meant that the color, transparency, and clarity of wine became important too. We are used to seeing what we drink, but this was new to the Romans, and they loved it. Although Roman wine glasses were the height of technical and cultural sophistication in their time, compared to modern glasses they were crude. The main problem was that they were full of bubbles. This was not just an aesthetic problem, it seriously weakened the glass. Whenever a material experiences mechanical stress, which might be caused by anything from being clinked against another glass to being dropped accidentally on the floor, it absorbs the force by dispersing it from atom to atom, reducing the total force that each individual atom has to absorb. Any atom that can't withstand the force being inflicted on it will be ripped from its position in the material, causing a crack. Wherever there is a bubble or crack, the atoms have fewer neighboring atoms to hold them in place and with which to share the force, and so these atoms are more prone to being ripped from position. When a glass smashes, it is because the force is so great that a chain reaction occurs within the material, with the failure of each atom causing the failure of its neighbor. The bigger the force, the smaller the bubble or crack needed to initiate this chain reaction. Or, to put it another way, large bubbles in your wine glass mean it won't be able to withstand much impact. The extreme fragility of glass might explain why glassmaking took so long to catch on after the Romans, despite their having made so much progress. The Chinese knew how to make glass and even traded for Roman glass, but they didn't develop it themselves. This is quite surprising, given that the Chinese mastery over materials technologies outshone that of the West for 1,000 years after the Roman Empire collapsed. The Chinese were experts in paper, wood, ceramic, and metals, but they pretty much ignored glass. By contrast, in the West, the fashion for wine glasses nurtured a respect and appreciation for glass that ultimately had a profound cultural impact. In Europe, and especially the colder northern Europe, transparent waterproof glass window panes, which let the light in but kept the elements out, were too desirable a technology to ignore. At first, only tiny panes of glass could be made that were of sufficient purity and consistency not to shatter, but these could be knitted together to make larger windows using lead. They could even be colored with glazes. Colored or stained glass windows became a means of expressing wealth and sophistication, changing entirely the architecture of the European cathedral. Over time, the artisans making stained glass for cathedrals became as high status as the masons who cut the stone, and in Europe, the new art of glazing blossomed. The disdain for glass in the East lasted all the way up until the 19th century. Before then, the Japanese and Chinese relied on paper for the windows of their buildings, a material that worked perfectly well but resulted in a different kind of architecture. The lack of glass technology in the East meant that, despite their technical sophistication, they never invented the telescope nor the microscope, and had access to neither until Western missionaries introduced them. Whether it was the lack of these two crucial optical instruments that prevented the Chinese from capitalizing on their technological superiority and instigating a scientific revolution, as happened in the West in the 17th century, is impossible to say. What is certain, though, is that without a telescope you can't see that Jupiter has moons, or that Pluto exists, or make the astronomical measurements that underpin our modern understanding of the universe. Similarly, without the microscope, it is impossible to see cells such as bacteria and to study systematically the microscopic world, which was essential to the development of medicine and engineering. So why is it that glass has this apparently miraculous property of transparency? How is it that light can travel through this solid material at all, while most other materials will not allow it? After all, glass contains all of the same atoms that make up a handful of sand. Why, in the form of sand, should they be opaque, and in the form of glass, transparent and able to bend light? Glass is made of silicon and oxygen atoms, as well as a few other sorts. Within every atom, there is a central nucleus which contains protons and neutrons, surrounded by varying numbers of electrons. The size of the nucleus and the individual electrons is tiny compared to the overall size of the atom. If an atom were the size of an athletic stadium, the nucleus would be the size of a pea at its center, and the electrons would be the size of grains of sand in the surrounding stands. So within all atoms, and indeed all matter, there is a majority of empty space. This suggests that there should be plenty of room for light to travel through an atom without bumping into either an electron or the nucleus. Which indeed there is. So the real question is not, why is glass transparent, but why aren't all materials transparent? Inside an atomic stadium, to continue the analogy, the electrons are only allowed to inhabit certain parts of the stands. It is as if most of the seats have been removed, and there are only certain rows of seats left, with each electron restricted to its allotted row. If an electron wants to upgrade to a better row, it has to pay more, the currency being energy. When light passes through an atom, it provides a burst of energy, and if the amount of energy provided is enough, an electron will use that energy to move into a better seat. In doing so, it absorbs the light, preventing it from passing through the material. But there is a catch. The energy of the light has to match exactly that required for the electron to move from its seat to a seat in the available row. If it's too small, or to put it another way, if there are no seats available in the row above, i.e. the energy required to get to them is too large, then the electron cannot upgrade and the light will not be absorbed. This idea of electrons not being able to move between rows, or energy states as they are called, unless the energy exactly matches, is the theory that governs the atomic world, called quantum mechanics. The gaps between rows correspond to specific quantities of energy, or quanta. The way these quanta are arranged in glass is such that moving to a free row requires much more energy than is available in visible light. Consequently, visible light does not have enough energy to allow the electrons to upgrade their seats, and has no choice but to pass straight through the atoms. This is why glass is transparent. High-energy light, on the other hand, such as UV light, can upgrade the electrons in glass to the better seats, and so glass is opaque to UV light. This is why you can't get a suntan through glass, since the UV light never reaches you. Opaque materials like wood and stone effectively have lots of cheap seats available, and so visible light and UV are easily absorbed by them. Even if light is not absorbed by glass, moving through the interior of an atom still affects it, slowing it down until it emerges from the other side of the glass, when it speeds up again. If the light strikes the glass at an angle, different parts of the light will enter it and emerge from it at different instants, forcing them to travel momentarily at slightly different speeds. This momentary difference is what causes the light to bend, or refract, and this is what makes an optical lens possible, with the curvature of the glass resulting in different angles of refraction at different points along its surface. Controlling the curvature of the glass means we can magnify images, which allows us to make telescopes and microscopes, and, for those of us who wear glasses, to see. It also, and perhaps more fundamentally, turns light into a subject for experimentation itself. Through the centuries, all glassmakers must have noticed that glass could create mini rainbows on the wall as sunlight hit it at particular angles. But no one could explain the cause, except to state the blindingly obvious, which is that the colors were somehow being generated within the glass. It wasn't until 1666 that Isaac Newton realized that what was blindingly obvious was blindingly wrong, and came up with the real explanation. Newton's moment of genius was to notice that a glass prism not only turned white light into a mixture of colors, but could also reverse the process. From this, he deduced that all of the colors created by a piece of glass were already in the light in the first place. They had traveled all the way from the sun as a ray of mixed light, only to be split up into their constituent colors when they hit the glass. The same thing would happen if they hit a drop of water, too, since this was also transparent. At a stroke, Newton had for the first time in history managed to explain the main features of the rainbow. The scientific explanation of an atmospheric phenomenon using a laboratory experiment showed the power of scientific reasoning. It also showcased the role of glass as laboratory accomplice in unraveling the mysteries of the world. This role was not limited to optics. Chemistry was transformed by glass perhaps more than any other discipline. You only have to go to any chemistry lab to see that the transparency and inertness of the material make it perfect for mixing chemicals and monitoring what they do. Before the glass test tube was born, chemical reactions were performed in opaque beakers, so it was hard to see what was happening. With glass, and especially with a new glass called Pyrex that was immune to thermal shock, chemistry as a systematic discipline really got going. Pyrex is a glass with boron oxide added to the mix. This is another molecule that, like silicon dioxide, finds it hard to form crystals. More importantly, as an additive, it counteracts the tendency of glass to expand when heated or contract when cooled. When different parts of a piece of glass are at different temperatures, expanding and contracting at different rates, stresses build up within the material as the different parts of the glass strain against one another. These stresses cause cracks to grow and ultimately shatter the glass. If this happens in a vessel containing boiling sulfuric acid, such a failure can maim or kill. The discovery of borosilicate glass, Pyrex is a trade name, put a stop to thermal expansion and the stresses associated with it. It released chemists to heat and cool their experiments as they wished, to concentrate on chemistry and not the potential dangers of thermal shock. Chemists were also able to bend glass tubes within the laboratory with the aid of only a blowtorch and to construct complex chemical equipment such as distillation vessels and gas-tight containers much more easily. Gases could be collected, liquids controlled, chemical reactions allowed to do whatever they liked. Glass equipment is the workhorse of the chemist's world, so much so that every professional chemical lab has a glass blower in residence. How many Nobel Prizes did this material make possible? How many modern inventions started life in a test tube? Whether the relationship between glass technology and the 17th century scientific revolution really is a simple case of cause and effect is an open question. It seems more likely that glass was a necessary condition rather than the reason for it. However, there is no doubt that glass was largely ignored in the East for 1,000 years, and during this time glass revolutionized one of Europe's most treasured customs. While glass has been used by the rich to drink wine for hundreds of years, most beers until the 19th century were drunk from opaque vessels such as ceramic, pewter, or wooden mugs. Since most people couldn't see the color of the liquid they were drinking, it presumably didn't matter much what these beers looked like, only what they tasted like. Mostly, they were dark brown and murky brews. Then in 1840, in Bohemia, a region in what is now the Czech Republic, a method to mass-produce glass was developed, and it became cheap enough to serve beer to everyone in glasses. As a result, people could see for the first time what their beer looked like, and they often did not like what they saw. The so-called top-fermented brews were variable not just in their taste, but in their color and clarity, too. Not 10 years later, a new beer was developed in Pilsen using bottom-fermenting yeast. It was lighter in color, it was clear and golden, it had bubbles like champagne. It was lager. This was a beer to be drunk with the eyes as much as with the mouth, and these light golden lagers have continued in this tradition ever since, being designed to be served in a glass. How ironic, then, that so much lager is drunk from an opaque metal can, meaning that the only beer uniquely identifiable for its visual appearance is the epitome of opaqueness, a beer in the old pre-glass tradition, Guinness. The move to serving beer in glasses had another unexpected side effect. According to the UK government, more than 5,000 people are attacked with glasses and bottles every year, costing the health service more than £2 billion to surgically repair the injured. Although many alternative plastic materials for serving beer in bars and pubs have been tried, materials which are both transparent and tough, they have never gained acceptance. Drinking beer from a plastic cup is a completely different experience to drinking from a glass. Not only does plastic taste different, but it also has a lower thermal conductivity, a property that makes it feel warmer than glass, reducing the satisfaction of drinking an ice-cold beer. Plastic is also much softer than glass, so plastic beer cups soon become tarnished, scratched, and opaque. This masks the clarity of the beer, but it also affects our perception of the cleanliness of the vessel. One of the great attractions of glass is that its shiny, bright appearance makes it seem clean even if it isn't, a collective deception we all accept in order to avoid thinking too much about using the same glass that was in a stranger's mouth perhaps only an hour before. Creating plastics that are hard enough to withstand scratching is a major goal for materials science. Such a discovery could then be used to make lighter windows for airplanes, trains and cars, and lighter screens for mobile phones. But so far it seems completely out of reach. In the meantime, we have found another solution to the problem. Instead of replacing glass, just make it safer. Such glass is called toughened glass, and was invented by the automobile industry in order to reduce the injuries caused by shards of glass in car crashes. The scientific origin of toughened glass is to be found in a famous curiosity of the 1640s known as Prince Rupert's Drops. These are teardrop-shaped pieces of glass that can withstand intense pressure at their rounded end, but if they incur the slightest damage at the tail end, they will explode. Prince Rupert's drops are very simple to make. All you need to do is drop a small piece of molten glass into water. The extreme and rapid cooling of the outside of the droplet puts the surface layers of the glass into a state of mechanical compression. All of the glass here is pushing in against itself, and as a result, cracks find it very hard to form, since the compression stress is always pushing the sides of the crack back together. This has the effect of toughening the outside of the glass to the point where the glass drop can, incredibly, withstand even a hammer blow. However, to maintain this compression stress in its surface, the laws of physics require an equal and opposite tensile stress in its interior. As a result, the atoms in the middle of the drop are in a state of high tension. They are all being pulled away from one another. They are, in effect, like a small explosion waiting to go off. If the surface compression becomes ever so slightly unbalanced, which can be achieved by making a small indent in the tail of the drop, a chain reaction courses through the whole material as all the atoms in tension snap back into place, and the material explodes into countless tiny shards. These shards are still sharp enough to cut, but they're small enough not to do any major damage. Getting windscreens to behave in a similar way was just a matter of finding a method for cooling the outside of the glass fast enough to create the state of compression found in Prince Rupert's drops. The material that resulted has saved countless lives in car crashes, where it dissolves characteristically into millions of tiny shards. Over the years, glass has been made even safer. The windscreen I hit in Spain was made of the latest generation of safety glass, called laminated glass. I knew this because although it shattered in the manner of Prince Rupert's drops, the fragments of the windscreen were held together in a single piece as we both made our journey across the bonnet of the car and onto the tarmac. This new generation of toughened glass has a layer of plastic in its middle, which acts as a glue keeping all the shards of glass together. This layer, known as a laminate, is also the secret behind bulletproof glass, which is essentially the same technology but with several layers of plastic embedded at intervals within the glass. When a bullet hits this material, the outermost layer of glass shatters, absorbing some of the bullet's energy and blunting its tip. The bullet must then push the glass shards through the layer of plastic beneath it, which flows like tough treacle, thus spreading the force over a wider area than the point of impact. No sooner has it got through this layer than the blunted bullet encounters another layer of glass, and the process starts all over again. The more layers of glass and plastic there are, the more energy the bulletproof glass can absorb. One layer of laminate will stop a 9mm pistol bullet. Three layers will stop a 44 Magnum pistol bullet. Eight layers will stop a person with an AK-47 rifle from killing you. Of course, there is little point in having a glass bulletproof window if you can't see through it, so the real challenge lies not so much in the layering of the materials, but in matching the refractive index of the plastic with that of the glass, so that light is not bent too much as it travels from one to the other. This technologically sophisticated laminated safety glass is more expensive to produce, but it is increasingly a price we are prepared to pay to enjoy its benefits. The material is popping up all over the place, not just in cars, but across modern cities as they become more and more like glass palaces. In the summer of 2011, there were riots in many city centres of the UK. Viewing the TV footage, I couldn't help but notice a difference between these and other such riots I had seen in the past. Occasionally, the rioters were unable to break the windows of shops by throwing a brick at them because many businesses had installed toughened safety glass. This trend is likely to increase, the shops using glass not just to present their wares, but to protect them too. This same laminated glass has been proposed as the material for new safety beer glasses, which would put an end to the use of glass as a weapon in bars and pubs. It is now impossible to imagine a modern city without glass. On the one hand, we expect our buildings to protect us from the weather. This is what they are for, after all. And yet, faced with a prospective new home or place of work, one of the first questions people ask is, how much natural light is there? The glass buildings that rise every day in a modern city are the engineering answer to these conflicting desires, to be at once sheltered from the wind, the cold, and the rain, to be secure from intrusion and thieves, but not to live in darkness. The life we lead indoors, which for many of us is the vast majority of our time, is made light and delightful by glass. Glass windows have come to signify that we are open for business, and that the business will be honest and open. A shop without a shop window is practically not a shop at all. This material is also instrumental in how we view ourselves. You may be able to see yourself reflected in a shiny metal surface or a pond, but for most of us, it is the glass mirror that has become the final intimate arbiter of our self-image. Even photographs and video representations are mediated through the glass lens. It is often said that there are very few places left on Earth that have yet to be discovered, but those who say this are usually referring to the places that exist at the human scale. Take a magnifying glass to any part of your house, and you will find a whole new world to explore. Use a powerful microscope, and you will find another, complete with a zoo of living organisms of the most fantastic nature. Alternatively, use a telescope and a whole universe of possibilities will open up before you. Ants build cities at their scale, and bacteria build cities at their scale. There is nothing special about our scale, about our cities, about our civilization, except that we have a material that allows us to transcend our scale. That material is glass. Yet we have no great love for the material that has made this possible. People do not tend to wax lyrical about glass in the way that they do about, say, a wooden floor or a cast-iron railway station. We do not run our hands down the latest double-glazed panel and admire the sensuality of this material. Maybe this is because, in its purest form, it is a featureless material, smooth, transparent, and cold. These are not human qualities. People tend to relate more to colored, intricate, delicate, or simply misshapen glass, but this is rarely functional. The most effective glass, the stuff we build our modern cities from, is flat, thick, and perfectly transparent, but it is the least likable, the least knowable, the most invisible. For all its considerable importance in our history and our lives, glass has somehow failed to win our affections. When we break a glass window, it is shocking, annoying, and painful in the case of my Spanish car accident. But we do not feel that we have broken something that is intrinsically valuable. In these situations, we are worried for ourselves, but as for the glass itself, it can be replaced. Perhaps it is because we look through it rather than at it that glass has not become part of the treasured fabric of our lives. The very thing that we value it for has also disqualified it from our affections. It is inert and invisible, not just optically, but culturally. 8. Unbreakable. The first time I went to art class, the teacher, a man called Barrington, told us that everything we could see was made of atoms. Everything. And that if we could understand that, we could begin to be artists. The room went quiet. He asked for questions, but all of us were struck dumb, wondering if we were in the right class. He continued his introduction to art by holding up his pencil and proceeding to draw a perfect circle on the piece of paper he had taped to the wall. There was general excitement and sighs of relief from the assembled pupils. Perhaps we were in an art class after all. "I've transferred atoms from the pencil to the paper," he observed. He then gave us a speech about the wonders of graphite as a material for artistic expression. "It is important to note," he said, "that although diamond is culturally revered as the superior form of carbon, it is in fact incapable of deep expression, and unlike graphite, no good art can come from diamond." What he subsequently thought of Damien Hirst's diamond-encrusted skull, for the love of God, valued at £50 million, I can only guess. But in describing the relationship between the two forms of carbon, diamond and graphite, as a rivalry, he was certainly correct. The battle between dark, expressive, utilitarian graphite and sublime, cool, hard, glinting diamond has been raging since antiquity. In terms of cultural value, diamond has long been the winner, but that may be set to change. A new understanding of graphite's inner structure has made it a source of wonder. 30 years after my introduction to graphite by my art teacher, I met Professor André Geim, one of the world's foremost carbon experts, in his fluorescent-lit office on the third floor of the physics department of Manchester University. I wish I could say that, like Barrington, he too used only graphite to express himself, but when he opened his desk drawer, I saw that it was full of ballpoint pens and whiteboard markers. In his thick Russian accent, André said, "There is no such thing as a perfect circle, Mark," leaving me a little unsure as to whether he had understood the point of my story. Then he fished out of the drawer a small red leather presentation case and said, "Have a look at that while I make the coffee." Inside the case was a disc of pure gold the size of a biscuit, decorated with a relief portrait of a man. As I weighed the heavy disc in my hand, I found it almost obscenely metallic. Gold is the full-fat cream of the metal world. I was taken aback by the decadence of the material. The man depicted was Alfred Nobel, and the inscription on the medal announced to the world that André Geim's team had received the 2010 Nobel Prize for Physics for his groundbreaking work on graphene, a two-dimensional version of graphite and a marvel of the materials world. As I waited for André to return with the coffee, I pondered his cryptic answer. Perhaps he was suggesting that although his last 10 years of research on carbon had been circular, he had not ended up where he started. Carbon is a light atom with 6 protons and usually 6 neutrons in its nucleus. Sometimes it contains 8 neutrons, but in this form, known as carbon-14, the atomic nucleus is unstable, and so the element falls apart through radioactive decay. Because the rate of this decay is consistent over long periods of time, and because this form of carbon finds its way into many materials, measuring its presence in a material allows us to work out that material's age. This scientific method, known as carbon dating, has thrown more light than any other on our ancient past. The true ages of Stonehenge, the Turin Shroud, and the Dead Sea Scrolls have all been revealed by this form of carbon. Radioactivity aside, the nucleus plays a backseat role in carbon. In terms of all its other properties and behavior, it is the 6 electrons that surround and shield the nucleus that are important. 2 of these electrons are deeply embedded in an inner core near the nucleus and play no role in the atom's chemical life, its interaction with other elements. This leaves 4 electrons, which form its outermost layer, that are active. It is these 4 electrons that make the difference between the graphite of a pencil and the diamond of an engagement ring. The simplest thing a carbon atom can do is share each of these 4 electrons with another carbon atom, forming 4 chemical bonds. This solves the problem of its active 4 electrons. Each electron is partnered off with a corresponding electron, belonging to another carbon atom. The crystal structure produced is extremely rigid. It is a diamond. The biggest diamond yet discovered is located in the Milky Way in the constellation of Serpens Cauda, where it is orbiting a pulsar star called PSR J1719-1438. It is an entire planet 5 times the size of Earth. Diamonds on Earth are minuscule by comparison. The biggest yet found is the size of a football. Extracted from the Cullinan mine in South Africa, it was eventually presented to King Edward VII in 1907 on his birthday, and is now part of the crown jewels of the British monarchy. This diamond was formed far below the surface of the Earth at a depth of approximately 300 kilometers, where, over the course of billions of years, the high temperatures and pressures converted a largest-sized carbon rock into the huge diamond. The diamond was then most likely carried to the surface of our planet during a volcanic eruption, where it lay inert and undisturbed for millions of years until it was discovered 1 mile underground. I was constantly being dragged to museums as a child, to the national this or that, and without exception I was bored in all of them. I tried to do what the adults did and walk around in ponderous silence or ruminate in front of a painting or a sculpture, but it didn't work for me. I got nothing out of it as far as I could fathom. It was very different when we visited the crown jewels. I was entranced from the moment I set foot inside. This was a true Aladdin's cave. The gold and jewels seemed to speak a fundamental language to me, more fundamental than art, more primitive. A feeling akin to religious devotion came over me. Looking back, I think that this experience was not a reveling in wealth, but was my reaction to being exposed for the first time to a pure form of materiality. There was a huge scrum of people in front of the Great Star of Africa diamond, as the largest gem from the Cullinan diamond was called after it was cut to shape. A mere glimpse of this diamond was enough for me never to forget it, even from my viewpoint under the armpit of a giant man wearing a damp lumberjack shirt and behind a tutting Indian woman. The presence of the Indian lady was appropriate, I later found out from my dad's encyclopedia, since India was the sole source of diamonds until the mid-18th century, when they were discovered in other parts of the world, most notably South Africa. Each diamond is, in fact, a single crystal. In a typical diamond, there are about 1 million billion billion atoms, perfectly arranged and assembled into this pyramidal structure. And it is this structure that accounts for its remarkable properties. In this formation, the electrons are locked into an extremely stable state, and this is what gives it its legendary strength. It is also transparent, but with an unusually high optical dispersion, which means that it splits light that enters it into its constituent colors, giving it its bright rainbow sparkle. The combination of extreme hardness and optical luster makes diamonds almost flawless as gemstones. Because of their hardness, virtually nothing can scratch them, and so they keep their perfectly faceted shape and pristine sparkle not just throughout the lifetime of the wearer, but throughout the lifetime of a civilization, through rain or shine, whether worn in a sandstorm, hacking through a jungle, or just doing the washing up. Even in antiquity, diamond was known to be the hardest material in the world. The word diamond is derived from the Greek adamas, meaning unalterable or unbreakable. Transporting the Cullinan diamond back to Britain posed an enormous security challenge for its owners, since the discovery of the largest ever rough diamond had been widely reported in the newspapers. Notorious criminals like Adam Worth, the inspiration for Sherlock Holmes's nemesis Moriarty, who had already managed to steal a whole shipment of diamonds, were perceived to be a real threat. In the end, a plan worthy of Sherlock Holmes was hatched and executed. A decoy stone was dispatched on a steamboat under high security, while the real one was sent by post in a plain brown paper box. The ruse worked precisely because of another remarkable attribute of diamond. Being composed solely of carbon, it is extremely light. The entire Cullinan diamond would have weighed little more than half a kilogram. Adam Worth was not alone. As the wealthy were acquiring large diamonds at an ever-increasing rate, a new type of occupation was being born at this time, that of cat burglar. Diamonds' lightness and high value meant that stealing a diamond, even one the size of a marble, could allow you to retire for life, and once stolen, it was essentially untraceable. Contrast this to stealing André Geim's gold medal, which would have gained me a few thousand pounds at most when melted down. This new type of jewel thief was imbued with the virtues of diamond itself, elegant, sophisticated, and unadulterated. In films such as To Catch a Thief and The Pink Panther, diamonds play the role of a princess cruelly imprisoned. Upstanding members of society by day, cat burglars by night, their rescuers were played by film stars like Cary Grant and David Niven. In these films, a diamond robbery is portrayed as a noble act. The diamond thief is light on his or her feet and requires only a black cat suit and a knowledge of sophisticated stately homes and combination safes located behind paintings. In contrast, the stealing of cash or gold from a bank or train was depicted as a grubby crime, often carried out by brutish and greedy men. Unlike gold, diamonds have never been part of the world's monetary system, despite their financial value. They are not a liquid asset. And quite literally so, they cannot be melted down and, in this way, commodified. Large diamond gemstones have no use except to arouse wonder and awe, and, most importantly, to affirm status. Before the 20th century, only the truly rich could afford them. But the growing wealth of the European middle classes provided a tempting new market for diamond miners. The problem faced by the company De Beers, which in 1902 controlled 90% of the world's diamond production, was how to sell to this much bigger market without devaluing the gems in the process. They managed it through a cunning marketing campaign. By concocting the phrase, "diamonds are forever," they invented the idea of the diamond engagement ring as the only true way to express everlasting love. Anyone who wished to convince their lover of the truth of their feelings needed to buy one. And the more expensive the diamond, the truer the feelings expressed. The marketing campaign took off spectacularly, catapulting a diamond into millions of households and culminating in a James Bond movie, accompanied by a Shirley Bassey, John Barry song, that enshrined the new social role of the diamond as the embodiment of romantic love. But diamonds are not forever, at least on the surface of this planet. It is, in fact, diamond's sibling structure, graphite, that is the more stable form, and so all diamonds, including the Great Star of Africa in the Tower of London, are actually turning slowly into graphite. This is distressing news for anyone who owns a diamond, although they can be reassured that it will take billions of years before they see an appreciable degradation of their gems. The structure of graphite is radically different from diamond. It consists of planes of carbon atoms connected in a hexagonal pattern. Each plane is an extremely strong and stable structure, and the bonds between the carbon atoms are stronger than those in diamond, which is surprising, given that graphite is so weak that it is used as a lubricant and as lead in pencils. The conundrum can be explained by noting that within the graphite layers, each carbon atom has three neighbors with which it shares its four electrons. In the diamond structure, each carbon atom shares its four electrons with four atoms. This gives the individual graphite layers a different electronic structure and stronger chemical bonding than diamond. The flip side, though, is that each atom in graphite has no electrons left over to form strong bonds between its layers. Instead, these layers are held together by the universal glue of the material world, a weak set of forces generated by fluctuations in the electric field of molecules, called van der Waals forces. This is the same force that makes blue tack sticky. The upshot is that when graphite is put under stress, it is the weak van der Waals forces that break first, making graphite very soft. This is how a pencil works. As you press it on the paper, you break the van der Waals bonds, and layers of graphite slide across one another, depositing themselves on the page. If it weren't for the weak van der Waals bonds, graphite would be stronger than diamond. This was one of the starting points for André Gide's team. Take a look at the graphite of a pencil, and you will see that it is dark grey and shiny like a metal. For thousands of years, it was mistaken for lead, and was referred to as plumbago, or black lead. Hence the use of the term lead to refer to the graphite used in a pencil. The confusion is understandable since they are both soft metals, although these days we call graphite a semi-metal. Plumbago mines became more and more valuable as new uses were found for graphite, such as the discovery that it was the perfect material to cast cannon and musket balls. In 17th and 18th century Britain, the material became so expensive that thieves took to digging secret tunnels into the mines, or working in the mines and secreting the plumbago about their person. As the price increased, so did the smuggling and criminal activity, until an Act of Parliament was passed in 1752 that made the stealing of graphite from a mine a felony punishable by a year's hard labour or 7 years' transportation to Australia. By 1800, graphite was such big business that armed guards were posted at the entrance to plumbago mines. The reason why graphite is metallic, while diamond is not, is also its hexagonal atomic structure. As we have seen, in the diamond structure, all four electrons in each carbon atom are partnered up with a corresponding electron. In this way, all atoms in the lattice are strongly held in a bond, and there are no free electrons. This is the reason why diamonds do not conduct electricity, because there are no electrons free to move within the structure to carry the electric current. In the graphite structure, on the other hand, the outer electrons do not just bond with a counterpart electron in a neighboring atom, but rather form a sea of electrons within the material. This has several effects, one of which is to allow graphite to conduct electricity, since the electrons can move around like fluid. Graphite was used by Edison for the first light bulb filaments because it also has a high melting point, which allows it to glow white hot without melting when a high current passes through it. Meanwhile, the sea of electrons also acts as an electromagnetic trampoline for light, and this reflection of light is what makes it appear shiny like other metals. This neat explanation of graphite's metallic properties is not what won André Gide's team a Nobel Prize, though. It was merely their starting point. All forms of life on Earth are based on carbon, and although these types of carbon appear very different from graphite, they can easily be converted into its hexagonal structure through burning. Wood turns into charcoal when heated. Bread becomes burnt toast. We too become black and charred when exposed to a fire. None of these processes produce pure, shiny graphite, since the hexagonal layers of carbon are not densely packed, but are jumbled up. But there is a vast spectrum of black, sooty materials, which all have one thing in common. They contain carbon in its most stable form, hexagonal sheets. In the 19th century, another form of black, sooty carbon rose to ascendancy, coal. The hexagonal planes of carbon atoms in coal are formed not through heat, as with a burnt piece of toast, but through geological processes acting on dead plant matter over millions of years. Coal starts off as a form of peat, but as heat and pressure act upon it, depending on the exact conditions, it is transformed into lignite, then bituminous coal, then anthracite coal, and finally graphite. What happens as it undergoes this transformation is that step by step it loses the volatile compounds containing nitrogen, sulfur, and oxygen that are present in the original plant matter, becoming in the process a purer and purer form of carbon. As the pure hexagonal layers get formed, so the material takes on a more metallic shine, which can be seen particularly clearly in the black mirror facets of some coals such as anthracite. Nevertheless, coal is very rarely a pure form of carbon, which is why it can be quite smelly when it burns. The type of coal most revered for its aesthetic appeal is that derived from fossilized monkey puzzle trees. It is hard, can be carved and polished to a brilliant finish, and has a beautiful dark black luster. It is sometimes called black amber because it has similar triboelectric properties to amber, the ability to generate static charge and make hair stand on end. We know it more commonly as jet. It was made fashionable in Britain in the 19th century by Queen Victoria, who mourned the death of her consort Prince Albert by wearing black clothes and jet jewellery for the rest of her life. There was subsequently such a popular demand for jet from the rest of the British Empire that overnight the population of the Yorkshire town of Whitby, where Bram Stoker later wrote his Gothic masterpiece Dracula, stopped using the large local deposits of jet for fuel and became famous for producing the jewellery of lament and sorrow. The idea that diamond has anything in common with coal or graphite was pure fantasy until early chemists started to investigate what happened when you heat it. Antoine Lavoisier did just this in 1772 and found that diamond burns when it gets red hot, leaving nothing. Nothing at all. It just seems to disappear into thin air. This experiment was extremely surprising. Other gemstones, such as ruby and sapphire, were found to be impervious to red heat or even white heat. They did not burn. But diamond, the king of gems, seemed to have an Achilles heel. What Lavoisier did next makes my heart sing, such is the elegance of the experiment. He heated diamond in a vacuum, so that there, with no air to react with the diamond, it might survive to higher temperatures. It's one of those experiments that is easy to propose but much harder to carry out, especially in the 18th century, when vacuums themselves were not so easy to produce. What happened next astounded Lavoisier. The diamond still wasn't impervious to red heat, but this time it turned into pure graphite, proof that these two materials were indeed made of the same stuff, carbon. Armed with this knowledge, Lavoisier and countless others across Europe searched for a way to reverse the process, to turn graphite into diamond. Vast wealth would be the reward for anyone who could do it, and the race was on. But the task was a formidable one. All materials prefer to change from less stable to more stable structures, and because the diamond structure is less stable than graphite's, it requires very high temperatures and pressures to persuade it to change in the opposite direction. These conditions exist inside the Earth's crust, but it still takes billions of years to grow a big diamond crystal. Simulating the conditions in a laboratory is extremely difficult. Claim after claim was made and then retracted. None of the scientists involved got massively rich overnight, which some said was further evidence of their failure. Others suspected that those who did achieve the feat of transformation kept quiet and got rich slowly. Whatever the truth, it wasn't until 1953 that there was reliable documented evidence of such a transformation being achieved. Now, the synthetic diamond industry is indeed big business, but it does not compete head-to-head with the natural diamond jewelry industry. There are a few reasons for this. The first is that although the industrial process has been mastered to the extent that small synthetic diamonds can be produced more cheaply than mining real ones, they are mostly coloured and flawed, since the accelerated process of making them introduces defects which colour the diamonds. In fact, the majority of these diamonds are used in the mining industry, where they embroider drills and cutting tools, not for aesthetic effect, but to enable them to cut through granite and other hard rocks. Secondly, much of the value of diamonds is derived from their authenticity. It is important when proposing marriage that the diamond you offer, although physically identical to a synthetic one, was forged in the depths of the earth 1 billion years ago. Thirdly, if you are the ultra-rational sort of person who does not care about the natural history of a gemstone, then buying a synthetic diamond is still a very expensive way to embellish your loved one. There are much cheaper lustrous substitutes that will glitter and dazzle and still fool anyone except a diamond expert, such as cubic zirconia crystals or even glass. However, the preeminence of natural diamond in its fight for supremacy with graphite was to take another blow when it was found that it was no longer the hardest known material. In 1967, it was discovered that there is a third way of arranging carbon atoms that produces an even harder substance than diamond. The structure is based on graphite's hexagonal planes, but modified to be three-dimensional. This structure, called Lonsdaleite, is thought to be 58% harder than diamond, although it exists in such small quantities that it is hard to test. The first sample was found in the Canyon Diablo meteorite, where the intense heat and pressure of impact transformed graphite into Lonsdaleite. An engagement ring has never been made from Lonsdaleite, since the types of meteorite impacts that create it are extremely rare and produce only tiny crystals, but the discovery of this third structure of carbon led, perhaps inevitably, to the question of whether yet further carbon structures could exist, in addition to the cubic structures of diamond, the hexagons of coal, jet, charcoal, and graphite, and the three-dimensional hexagonal structure of Lonsdaleite. Soon, another synthetic one joined the list, thanks to the aircraft industry. Early aircraft were made of wood because it is light and stiff. Indeed, one of the fastest aircraft in the Second World War was a wooden airplane called the Mosquito. Making airframes out of wood is problematic because it's hard to join into a defect-free structure. So, as the scale of aircraft engineers' ambitions increased, they turned instead to a light metal called aluminum. But even aluminum is not super light, and nagging away at the back of many engineers' minds was the hope that there might somehow be a material that was stronger and lighter even than aluminum. It didn't seem to exist, so in 1963, engineers from the Royal Aircraft Establishment in Farnborough decided to invent one. Carbon fiber, as they named it, was made by spinning graphite into a fiber. By rolling sheets of this material up, with the fibers running lengthwise, they could take advantage of the huge strength and stiffness within the sheets. The weakness, as with pure graphite, still lay in the material's structural dependence on van der Waals forces. But this was overcome by encasing the fibers in an epoxy glue. A new material was born, carbon fiber composite. Although this material would, in the end, displace aluminum in the building of aircraft, the recent Boeing Dreamliner is 70% carbon fiber composite, it took a long time for carbon fiber to prove itself worthy of the aircraft industry. Sports equipment manufacturers, however, took a liking to it immediately. It transformed the performance of racket sports so quickly that those who stuck to traditional materials such as wood and aluminum were quickly outclassed. I remember vividly that moment in my life when my friend James appeared on the tennis court one day wielding a composite tennis racket with the characteristic black-on-black checkered patterning of carbon fiber. Before we played the match, he allowed me to experience its extreme lightness and power with a few practice shots, and then swapped back and thrashed me. There is something highly unnerving about playing an opponent who has a racket that is half the weight and has twice the power of yours. "You carbon be serious," I explained. It didn't help. Soon the material was changing any and every sport that required low weight and high power materials. In other words, pretty much all of them. Bicycle racing was transformed in the 1990s when engineers started to produce bikes with ever more aerodynamic shapes using carbon fiber structures. The development of these bikes probably reached its zenith in Chris Boardman's classic sporting rivalry with Graham Obrey to beat the hour record, the competition that seeks to determine the furthest a human being can travel in 1 hour under their own power. In the 1990s, both cyclists were able to smash the world record and then each other's records repeatedly with the help of ever more sophisticated carbon fiber bicycles. In 1996, Chris Boardman rode 56.375 kilometers in 1 hour and provoked an outcry from the International Cycling Union. They promptly banned the use of these new carbon fiber-inspired designs, so worried were they by how radically the bikes would change the nature of the sport. Formula One took the opposite approach to the innovation offered by carbon fiber, with constant changes in the rules forcing further innovation in materials design. Indeed, mastery of technology is integral to the sport, and success is achieved as much through engineering advances as it is through the skill of the driver. Meanwhile,